Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill is in re-election mode as she goes after a second term later this year. And she says she feels like an underdog. The poll suggests she's running dead even with her three Republican rivals who spent much of their weekend in Kansas City trying to tie the senator to the president she backed in 2008, Barack Obama. But McCaskill says she's an independent voice, and today we'll get an update from her about her work on Capitol Hill. Later on this hour, we look at the life of trailblazing former Congresswoman Barbara Jordan. But first up, Senator Claire McCaskill, who's in town today. And, Senator, it's always good to have you.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
People are getting concerned about gasoline prices, Senator. It's inching towards $4 a gallon. What do you think needs to be done at the federal level to deal with that?
Well, there's a couple of things going on. I think Iran is a big part of it. But also, I continue to scratch my head over the top five oil companies in the world shutting down refining capacity in this country. We were a net exporter of oil in the United States last year. We are drilling more oil than we ever have in the United States. We have more domestic production, more rotary wells in the ground. Just last Friday, the administration opened up more lease land in the Arctic up north. So we are trying to have an all-of-the-above energy strategy in this country. But shutting down refining capacity appears to be playing with supply because demand's down because natural gas has gotten so inexpensive. So it's a little tricky to deal with this, and there's speculation out there because of Iran. I think one thing that we can do is really take a look at opening up the National Reserve again. The administration did that once before.
And President Obama's looking at that idea?
Well, he did it before. They did it before as a, I think, a way to tell the speculators, be careful. You know, we are capable of doing this and don't get way too out here on speculation and drive cost up. You know, I disagreed with the decision on Keystone. I support the Keystone pipeline. And so I think, but frankly, that's not really part of this equation right now.
But you're saying America was a net exporter of gasoline last year?
Correct.
That'll surprise a lot of people.
And it surprises people when they realize we're drilling more oil now than we did under George Bush domestically. I think there is some kind of false notion out there that drilling has shut down in the United States. Just the opposite.
So it does make you wonder, why are gasoline prices going up now then? You ever get suspicious of these things as you watch these prices bounce up and down?
Well, it's a commodity that's being traded on the open market. And people are seeing what Iran is doing in the Straits of Hormuz, and they're assuming that supply is going to go down, and therefore price is going to go up, and they're speculating, and that's driving the price higher. They also refining capacity shutting down, which it has in the last – I think they just shut a refinery down in the last 6 months. That is adding to this. But they've got to be careful here because if it goes too high, then it really chases people over to natural gas. And they get in more trouble. So it would not shock me to see Saudi Arabia opening up the spigot a little bit more. I think that's why people need to understand that our foreign policy in the Middle East cannot fit on a bumper sticker. There is no, you know, one-word phrase or five-word phrases that fix how complicated our foreign policy is in the Middle East as it relates to our friends, our enemies, and oil.
Let's turn to a different topic. The Senate just passed a payroll tax extension bill. You voted for it. Why did you think it was a good idea?
Well, it's hard to find an economist that doesn't realize that this adds about a half a point to a point of GDP to our country a year. That translates into jobs. It is money that is circulating because payroll tax cuts go immediately into the economy. You know, you cut taxes on dividends, then a lot of money goes into accounts where they sit or they goes into – but when you do a payroll tax cut – people generally circulate that money in the economy.
But to be clear, this is not new money, right? This is just extending a cut that's been in place for a while.
It's a cut that was put in place during the stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
This happened during the stimulus. People don't realize that almost a third of the stimulus was tax cuts. I think people heard stimulus and thought, shovels, and part of that was the fault of Washington talking too much about the shovels and not enough about the tax cuts. But about two-thirds of the stimulus was saving the states with money that went directly to Jeff City, and tax cuts and unemployment benefits.
And this extends the tax cut until the end of the year.
Correct. The payroll tax cut till the end of the year.
Then Congress will have to act again on whether to continue or not.
Correct. And also the Bush tax cuts are up for renewal at the end of the year. So there will be a lot of decisions made at the end of the year about tax policy going forward.
What's your forecast, or does it depend on how the economy does this year?
Well, I think I think a lot of it depends, frankly, on what the voters say in November in some regard. Many of us believe that we've got to focus like a laser on the middle class and folks that have always been the strength of our economy, the people that are the consumers in this nation of goods and services, and making sure that the tax burden for them is reasonable and keeping the tax burden for them from going up. I'm not as concerned about folks paying 3% more on their second or third million. That's not a concern of mine. Anybody who thinks a 3% differential in the top tax rate for people on their second $1 million makes a difference in their investment decisions and their businesses is not being realistic.
Do you think the Democrats are winning that argument, this whole notion of taxing the rich or not? Are the Democrats going to come out ahead on this thing?
I don't think it's a matter of taxing the rich. I think it's a matter of focusing. I think the Democrats come out ahead when we focus on where the real job creators are, which is you know, the middle class. And it's not people on their second million. And that's where we have kind of drawn the line. And I think most Missourians support that, that we can, you know, and I'm not, I mean, I'm for lowering the corporate rate, but raising that top rate back up to where it was in the Clinton administration, when, by the way, everybody did really well. And we created exponentially more jobs at that slightly higher rate for the top bracket than we are at the rate that George Bush put in place.
You know, one thing about the payroll tax cut, and that money is coming out of the Social Security pot, and you wonder if you can begin to imagine Congress, whether at the end of this year or at some point down the road, saying, okay, we're going to go back up to 6%, which is where it was prior to the cuts in the stimulus program. And that would then mean, Senator, a 50% increase in the payroll tax to bring it from where it is today back up to where it used to be. Can you envision Congress doing that, you know, given the amount of anger and wrath that would bear down on some members for voting for a tax increase at that point?
Well, I think most Americans know that this was a temporary thing that was done because of a dramatic recession that our country faced.
Yeah.
It's like saying, well, what about the money we gave to the states? How do we cut that off? Well, we have.
Mm-hmm.
Not easy. People in Jeff City said they didn't like the stimulus, but they didn't really talk much about the fact that they took $4 billion of it and balanced the budget with it.
And they spent it, yeah.
And spent it. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I think that as long as we are upfront with folks that this is something that's temporary, it's not permanent, and that it is because of an economic crisis that occurred, not under the watch of this administration, but under the watch of the previous administration. And it was necessary to do some extraordinary things to try to get us back on the right path. We're not well, but we are a whole lot better than we were in the closing months of 2008 and the beginning months of 2009.
We're visiting with Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. If you want to join our conversation with a question, you can always do it. 816-235-2888 is our number, our email address, update@kcur.org, or you can go to KCUR's Facebook page. Let's go to a phone call here. Liz from Kansas City, Missouri. Liz, you're on Up to Date with Claire McCaskill. Good morning.
Good morning to you both, and thank you so much for taking my call. My biggest concern right now is the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which allows unlimited corporate donations in the form of super PACs to go to every level of political elections. And my question to you, Claire, is there something that you would like to try to do in order to change this? You know, I personally think calling for a constitutional convention to change it is the way to go. I'd like your opinion on it, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Liz.
Well, the first step is the Disclose Act. And if you read the Citizens United decision, you can read in some of the dissents pretty much a directive by some of the Supreme Court judges saying, you know, the Congress needs to make the corporate leaders more accountable for these donations that they're making. And I think if after this election cycle, I don't think we're going to get anything done now, because the times that we have tried to vote on disclose, and what disclose basically does is say you can give, but you got to tell. So that the people in Missouri right now, I've had millions of dollars of super PAC money already spent against me in this election cycle. Millions. And it's just February. You know, this election cycle is going to reach a new low in American politics in terms of the money being washed around the airwaves without the donor's identity being disclosed. And I think that's very, very important, that transparency. I'm hopeful that after this election, we might even get some of my Republican colleagues to sign up for transparency as it relates to these advertisements. Because I'll be honest with you, I think both sides are going to do it. Because if one side doesn't participate, then they're going to get killed.
I was going to say, do you think the pro-Democratic side will spend in amounts equal to what you're going to see on the other side, Senator?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like that old Western, you know, where somebody stands and goes, and calls the cavalry over the hill. I'm blowing that trumpet as hard as I can blow it. And because it does feel – it's scary to me to have this kind of money spent against and obviously, from my perspective, they're incredibly distorted and unfair, these ads. And I feel helpless about what to do about it. So I would love to see the Citizens United case overturned. I would love to see us figure out a way to amend our Constitution to keep the First Amendment as robust as we all depend on it to be. But trying to figure out a way to take some of this corporate money out of the equation, at a minimum, we ought to be able to disclose where it's coming from so people know who's paying for these ads. I think if people knew who are paying for these ads against me, these ads might help me.
Yeah. Well, you can't envision a scenario where the Supreme Court overturns its own ruling, or can you?
Isn't it
up to Congress to pass a new law here? Isn't that?
Well, Congress would have to pass a new law, but you know, the Supreme Court makeup of the Supreme Court changes. So there could be a time someday that a different Supreme Court could say, you know, corporations aren't people. And there can be different rules for corporations.
That would be sometime down the road.
Sometime
presumably.
Down the road.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. So, yeah, I was watching TV last night. I had a special on Bill Clinton, and I was really struck. I'd kind of forgotten some of the details of his first couple years in office. They talked about his first budget that he barely passed. It was one of his biggest accomplishments. And at that time, we were coming out of a recession like we are now, and his budget cut spending and raised taxes, and it led to the biggest growth of the economy that the basically we've ever had, about 12 years of growth, solid growth,
right.
And just kind of wondering, you know, if maybe some people in Washington will look back at history and look at things that have worked in the past rather than pulling things out of thin air and hoping they work.
The Democrats have been making that case. You've made it today that, hey, Clinton did it. The world didn't go to a heck in a hound basket, and why not try it again?
Well, and I think people need to realize that one of the things that stopped the compromise, the president and Speaker Boehner had a big compromise that would have done a lot of what Clinton's first budget bill did. But it would have actually lowered taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have taken a lot of the revenue from cleaning out the tax code from all the special goodies and applied it towards the long-term debt. And that's where Speaker Boehner hit a brick wall in his caucus, walked away from that compromise because too many people in Speaker Boehner's caucus said every tax cut we do has to go back into the pockets of taxpayers. None of it can be used to address our long-term debt, the long-term imbalance in our budget. In other words, they want to do all this by dismantling the federal government, including programs that America likes and relies on, like Medicare.
Republicans have been basically, largely, unmovable on this point in terms of raising taxes for anything. What do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting. David Stockman, who was an economist working in the Reagan administration,
right.
He's been very articulate about this, that he thinks – and other moderate Republicans Does any Republican think that the answer to our fiscal problem is raising taxes? No, I don't either. But a balanced approach, even though maybe it's not in my political best interest to talk about a balanced approach, I think that's the responsible thing to do. Look at all three legs of the stool. Look at reforming the entitlements in a way that is more fair and reasonable. Look at cutting spending, which I have been very active and aggressive about, including a spending cap bill that started way before the 2010 elections with one of my Republican colleagues that I got in a lot of trouble in my caucus for, and also in the tax code. And if we look at this balanced approach, we can get our fiscal house back in order without completely ripping and shredding the safety net or the programs like Medicare and Social Security that so many Americans depend on and that are very popular with Americans.
You know, it seems like, Senator, last year reducing the deficit was all the rage. And this year, suddenly that topic has, by and large, sort of gone off the radar screen. Why does that happen? Is it just because it's an election year and everyone sort of knows that no serious work on the deficit will be done in an election year?
Well, there's two problems. There's the deficit and there's the debt. And they are not the same. Mm-hmm. It's too many times people use those terms interchangeably as if they're the same. They are much different.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the deficit, I mean, if we turned out the lights on federal spending, our economy would fall off the cliff again. So we've got to get on a glide path to lower deficits.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on that glide path. There isn't a lot of progress that's going to be made in the next fiscal year. But then after that, the deficit begins to go down, and then it will start to climb again after 3 or 4 years if we don't get a handle on these entitlements and on the tax code issues. But long term, you know, I like to point this out to people. If we quit spending every dime in the federal government, no more highways, no more foreign aid, no more education, no more agriculture, none of that. All of it gone. And all we were spending money on was Social Security, Medicare, and defense.
Mm-hmm.
We still have long-term deficit debt.
Hmm.
So this is about an all-of-the-above approach and doing something in every silo, spending, entitlements, and the tax code. And I'm going to keep preaching that as long as people will have me, and because I think it's honest and it's reasonable.
I guess the good news is, if you're a deficit hawk, is the idea, the climate around the idea of tinkering and reforming and messing with entitlements, that seems to have – we've rounded the corner on that idea. It used to be touching the third rail of American politics. I know it's still tricky, but you do get a sense that more and more politicians from both parties are sort of acknowledging we've got to make changes there.
Well, I think you've got to be honest about this stuff. You know, one of the things that's hardest about our politics today is everyone wants to take the bumper sticker approach and play to people's anger and play to their distrust of government and feed red meat kind of to everyone. You know, Washington is evil. Everyone is evil. Both parties, you know, one party says the other party is evil. The other party says the other party is evil. None of that is really true.
Yeah.
And what really is true is you've got to take a more balanced approach to all of this stuff. And it doesn't fit on a bumper sticker. Now, Medicare. This is a great example. My husband is the age that Medicare begins to kick in. Should the government be buying any of my husband's prescription drugs? Of course not. You know, I mean, absolutely not. Should Warren Buffett have the ability to have taxpayers pay for any of his prescription drugs? This is a bad idea. By the way, put in place by the Republican Congress and George Bush. The most expensive entitlement program that's been passed is Medicare D, without really aggressive means testing.
Yeah.
We can't keep buying things with taxpayer money that people can afford to pay for. We can't. And that's the kind of, I think, reforms that are necessary and reasonable and that most Missourians will accept.
Claire McCaskill is our guest. She's a U.S. Senator from Missouri. Our number, 816-235-2888. Our email address, update@kcur.org. Senator Beth writes us this. After the bank bailout, you brought up the insult of the tremendous bonuses going to the bank officials. I never read or heard anything more, and I note that this year there were approximately $26 billion. Correct me if I'm wrong, she says, in bonuses. Can there at least be certain tax rates for this type of earned income?
Well, we were able to put some rules on those institutions that had not paid back their TARP money. Now, I don't really think the government has a place telling private companies what they can compensate folks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the government's place to do that. But if the government has given them a lifeline, then as long as they're using that lifeline, I think they have an obligation to be very circumspect in the amount of bonuses mm-hmm. and salaries that folks at the very top get. And I think that was appropriate to do under those circumstances. But, you know, raising the tax rate on the top bracket from 35 to 38.5 or from 35.5 to 39, whatever it is, it's 3.5 points at that bracket. That would apply in the bills we voted on. That would apply to people on their second million and above. So it would, in fact, be an extra tax on folks who get millions of dollars in bonuses.
Rex writes us this, Senator, Social Security is not an entitlement. It's a program I have paid into for over 40 years. It is not something that the government is going to give to me out of the goodness of their hearts. We have earned it. It is relatively easy to fix, and thank God that they didn't privatize it during the Bush administration.
Yeah, I don't like the word entitlement either, because it does give the people the sense that somehow it's something that they haven't invested in. There are people that get more money back in Social Security payments than they paid in.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a lot of the SSI that is paid out pays out much more than the person who paid in originally paid. And certainly with Medicare, I don't think people realize that what you pay towards Medicare is just a very small portion of what Medicare costs. And most of that is paid for. A lot of it is paid for with general revenue dollars. So it is important that we fix Social Security, and your listener's right. Fixing Social Security is not that hard. I mean, does anybody really believe that my grandson, who's a year old, is going to mind if he retires 18 months later, if mm-hmm. he knows that from the minute he's old enough to work
right.
until he retires? I don't think that's a problem. I think we can look to generations to come, and because we are retiring later. People are working
yes.
longer, and there is a legitimate reason to look at the demographics of Social Security. Certainly, we cannot change the rules of the road for people who have counted on a certain level of Social Security in their planning and that are in the workforce now. But for people who haven't entered the workforce, I think we can look at some slight adjustments, a little more means testing on Social Security, and get where we need to go on Social Security. Medicare is the harder one.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. We'll turn to earmarks, contractors, and her efforts to extend the post office and keep it where it is today. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation with Senate historian Donald Ritchie about presidents and Congresses getting along and soldier, diplomat, and activist Anne Wright's take on U.S. foreign policy, you'll find them both along with all of our shows at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, former Congressman Dennis Moore and his wife Stephanie visit with us about his recent diagnosis of early onset Alzheimer's disease. That's tomorrow on the program. This hour, we're visiting with Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill about a whole host of issues. 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org. You know, Senator, when you talk about the budget deficit, as we were doing in our first half today, it's easy to get to the topic of earmarks. These are these special appropriations that members of Congress fight for projects back home. You've been waging war against earmarks for a while now. How goes the battle?
Well, actually, we've made really good progress. When I first came to Washington, I really didn't campaign against earmarks because, frankly, I didn't really understand how it worked. I got there coming out of the auditor's office and began realizing how this process worked. And I said, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing it. I mean, they pass around little slips of paper and you know, it's like, okay, you get this much. And I couldn't get anybody to tell me who even decided who got how much. And if you were a ranking member on a certain appropriations committee, you get what's called a honeypot.
Yeah.
You know, and that doesn't even sound good.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was really a process that was not based on merit. It was not based on any kind of formula that made sense in terms of spending public money. It's all based on who you know, what party you were in, how senior you were, what committee you served on. And that's a dumb way to spend public money. And it robs – people think, well, this earmark money grew on trees. They robbed other programs to create these slush funds to earmark out of. So the programs they were robbing from are the programs that are decided on merit, are decided by formula, whether it's the highways that we build in Missouri that are decided locally, which projects, deciding that one congressman or one senator's judgment is smarter than all of the local planning for highways.
Yeah.
Deciding that, you know, one guy in Washington knows better about how to address law enforcement needs than a competitive grant process through the Department of Public Safety at the state level for prosecutors and sheriffs. So I just said, I'm done. And I started fighting it. And I was made fun of. I was marginalized. I was, frankly, criticized openly by members of my own party. Caucus meetings were awkward and uncomfortable. And they laughed at me like I could ever do anything about earmarks. And there were just a couple of us at the time that were Democrats and only four or five Republicans. So this is one thing that the Tea Party movement did that was really good. They really heightened everyone's awareness about earmarking. And as a result, we've got moratoriums on earmarking now. I've got a permanent ban that I'm trying to get passed with Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania. We didn't get it passed, but we did get the moratorium extended another year.
Mm-hmm.
So the longer we have this moratorium on earmarks, the better chance that we go back to funding these programs based on need, not based on who you know.
You know, in December, you accused a Republican committee chair of engineering what you called an elaborate scheme to deviate around the GOP pledge to not allow these costly pet projects that are widely scorned by some members of the public. What happened there?
We caught the defense authorization bill in the House was earmarked. They created a slush fund.
After saying they wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They created a slush fund and everybody put their projects in. And they said, well, they did it by amendment. Well, they did it by amendment. Like they put like 30, 40 projects in one amendment. Nobody had read them. Nobody knew what they were. They said, oh, it's going to be all competitive. But we checked. We did a very aggressive study on this, similar to what we do with an audit, and found that a lot of these projects were identical to the language that had previously been earmarked. And in fact, members of the committee sent out press releases bragging about how they'd gotten these projects passed. So we exposed that, and they pulled all of it. We were able to get them out of the bill and stopped it from happening.
In that analysis, you found earmarks from both Republicans and Democrats, right?
Both.
40 earmarks from Republicans, 75 from House Democrats.
And those are the ones that we could prove were earmarks. Mm-hmm. We think there were others that were, but because people had taken their previous requests for earmarks off their websites, we had a very rigorous test because we didn't want to overstate it, what we could prove. But we believe we proved those were earmarks. We think a lot more of them were earmarks, but they were certainly both parties that participated. And it was, you know, obviously the committee was controlled by the Republicans.
Jake from Kansas City, Missouri. Jake, you're on with Senator Claire McCaskill. Good morning. You there, Jake? You know, Jake was going to ask a question about Afghanistan. And speaking of that, you've been working on cracking down on the work of private contractors working for the government, some of them in Afghanistan. You've uncovered a lot of problems there. Where does your work on that issue stand right now?
We are doing a lot. I convinced the Senate to create a subcommittee on contracting, and I chair that committee. And it's like shooting fish in a barrel. We could do four hearings a month and find new contracting abuses. It was amazing to me as an auditor when I realized how badly the federal government was handling its responsibility of contracting, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan. And my trips to Iraq and Afghanistan have been in the contracting space. In fact, I will tell you, I have a lot of days in this job that I scratch my head and go, gosh, this is hard. Then every once in a while, there's a day that I go, woohoo. And I had a woohoo day because somebody who works at the Congressional Research Service went over to Afghanistan on an assignment and was there and came back and called my staff and said, you need to hear this story. I was in Afghanistan in a meeting, and there were a bunch of folks there from the command staff, and they said, well, we could do this in a contract. And somebody in the room said, if we do that, McCaskill's staff will be all over it. And I'm going, woohoo, all the way in Afghanistan. They know that we're paying really close attention. So we've made some progress. One of the things I'm doing right now, that an amendment that I hope to get a vote on next week, I'm trying to pull the $400 million in the Afghanistan Reconstruction Fund, pull that money from Afghanistan for building highways and bridges in Afghanistan, and put it in our Highway Trust Fund to build highways and bridges here. We have built too many projects in Afghanistan that can't be sustained. It is a waste of money. Do we still need to be doing things to train the Afghanistan folks on rule of law and taking out the Taliban? I think we still have a military function there, but it is we can draw down over time. But this notion that we need to be rebuilding the infrastructure of their country and paying off the bad guys for security, roads that get blown up after we build them, you'd think we would have learned the lesson after Iraq when we built all kinds of infrastructure that was destroyed before it was all said and done, and a lot of the money walked away. So I'm trying to pull that $400 million out of Afghanistan and put it back into building roads and bridges here.
Do you think the decision to gradually withdraw from Afghanistan, is that the right thing to be doing right now?
I think it is.
Is our mission there largely over?
I think it is. I think people – foreign policy is really an area where it is – I look at what Senator Rand Paul is trying to do on the highway bill, which is cut off all the aid to Egypt as a result of them holding some employees of non-governmental organizations that have been over there working on, for democracy. That is so short-sighted. If you look at – the big picture in the Middle East and who we need to be allies and what we're trying to impact, which is difficult to do, partly because of the war in Iraq. The West has become the favorite whipping boy for bad guys in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And so walking the relationships with Pakistan, with Egypt, with Saudi Arabia, with what's going on in Syria, with what we have in Libya, all of that. I think there is so much work to be done in terms of our readiness and our ability to keep our country safe that it is very difficult to do what we're doing in Afghanistan at the level we're doing and maintain national security on all those other fronts. And so I think we do need to begin to draw down out of Afghanistan. I support that. But we've got to continue to stay very focused, particularly on our relationship with Pakistan.
Claire McCaskill is our guest. She's a U.S. Senator from Missouri. Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning, Senator McCaskill. Listen, I want to let you know I was very happy that you took my call. I wanted to let you know I did vote for you in the last election. I did have a question for you. I was really disappointed with the fact that I saw you sign for the NDAA Act. And I wanted to know how you see yourself fit to be reelected when you voted for an act to take away civil liberties.
This is the National Defense Appropriations Authorization.
Act,
What is that, Senator?
It's the annual authorization, and what we did in that bill, I think, has been widely, widely mischaracterized. There is nothing – in fact, we specifically voted for amendment that said nothing in this bill should change the rights of American citizens as they exist. The right of habeas corpus is there. The right of habeas corpus has been established by our courts under these circumstances, and we specific – and I have signed on as a co-sponsor with Senator Feinstein to reiterate that, that no American citizen should ever be able to be held without their constitutional rights. On the other hand, we also have to realize that if we make America a safe haven for people who want to bring down our government even, unfortunately, some people who have American citizenship, then that is also a mistake. So I think what we did is an approach that is reasonable in light of the threats against our country, but also stays firmly focused on American citizens' rights to always have their day in court about why they're being held. And that was maintained in this bill. And we're going to underline it with an exclamation point with the bill that Senator Feinstein has drafted and that I am a co-sponsor of.
Joe, thank you. Let's go to Steve from Lee Summit. Steve, good morning.
Yes, I was wondering what you've done during your term and what you intend to do in the remainder of your term to to quell this illegal immigration, and I'd like a short follow-up if I could.
Sure.
Thanks, Steve. I'll keep you on.
I have co-sponsored legislation that did a lot to add resources at the border, including drone photography, including more boots on the ground on the border, more technology that allows us to effectively secure our border. I have been an incessant voice about employer enforcement. People are not coming across the border for a vacation. They're coming for employment. And too often, in fact, when I got to Washington, believe it or not, I took the head of Homeland Security and the head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the Bush administration, and I said, how many employers have been prosecuted for knowingly hiring illegal immigrants? They said, we don't even keep those numbers. I said, you've got to be kidding me. You're not even keeping track of employers that are held accountable. And in fact, the truth be known, the previous administration looked the other way on employer enforcement and allowed this cheap labor force that many times was, you know, they were not withholding, not a safe workplace, not withholding the taxes that the businessmen that play by the rules and women that play by the rules were withholding. It was really an uneven playing field. So I've worked very hard to put pressure on this administration to go after employers who knowingly hire illegal immigrants. They are the magnet. And if we effectively shut that magnet down, we're going to help with the problem. And in fact, immigration is down. Illegal immigration is down in this country right now. And I think that's part of it, is we're doing more on enforcement on the employer side.
Steve, you had a follow-up. If you could go quickly, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, I was wondering, you said that they come here for employment. Yeah, sure, some do, but I tell you, ma'am, that I see on a daily basis that people come to this country to milk our welfare system, and they are experts at it. And when you have, it really hits home, when you have somebody say to your face who's illegal, you need to pay more money to take care of my kids. That really hits home.
Okay. I'm going to take you off there, Steve. And a lot of folks disagree sharply with what you're saying. Senator, you want to respond?
Well, I think that I have asked the IRS why they are not asking for legitimate Social Security numbers on the child tax credit. I think it's important they do. I don't think illegal immigrants should be allowed to access the benefits that American citizens have. But I don't think that it is wise for our country to make this about the children. You know, I it shouldn't be about the children. I don't want to have policies that are a magnet for illegal immigrants. On the other hand, I don't think we should be making political points off kids.
Senator, just real quickly here, you're working to keep post offices open 6 days a week, and you're fighting to keep rural post offices open. You going to win this thing?
I hope so. You know, keeping rural post offices open is a very, 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 very tiny percentage of the fiscal problems that the Postal Service faces. This is more about unshackling them in terms of their ability to be entrepreneurial and compete against their competitors. You know, we've not allowed them to do a lot of things that would make sense from a business model. And we've also forced them to pre-fund their pensions and their health care benefits for 75 years. Well,
yeah.
Nobody has to do that.
I didn't understand that. When you had a news conference here, that just seems amazing to me. Where did that requirement come from?
It came from a piece of legislation. You know,
yeah.
You know, it was an effort, I think, at the time for the workers to make sure that their pensions and health care was going to be funded. And they didn't realize that it might be short-sighted in the long run because it would put such a cash flow stress on the Postal Service.
So in theory, is the post office doing better than we all think it is?
Well, Here's the tricky part of this. First class mail is going to continue to go down. But you know what? Packages are going to continue to go up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't know about you, Steve Kraske, but I know what I did for a lot of Christmas shopping. I did go to brick and mortar, but a whole lot of it were packages on the internet. And that is an uptick.
Mm-hmm.
So maintaining the competitive advantage of six-day delivery, which FedEx and UPS don't have, and competing for that space in terms of packages and providing more entrepreneurial ability for the Postal Service to compete with FedEx and UPS, I think is the key to keeping rural post offices the heart of their communities like they are now.
Yeah.
And I'm going to fight hard to do that because I think it's the right thing to do for rural Missouri.
Senator, I know you got to scoot. Thanks for coming in today.
You
Thanks
bet.
For your time,
it was great
as
to
always.
Be back in studio with you. Good to see you.
You bet. That's Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill.